From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in today for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, writing spy novels in the post-Cold War era. Spy novelist John le Carré says he was ready for a change anyway. His new novel is about the fallout from the Cold War, the clandestine world of international arms dealing. Also, Losing Your Temper and Other Foibles of Coaching Little League. We talk with Bill Geist, Little League coach and correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Kamakiria, the new solo album by Donald Fagen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Sudan's ambassador to the United Nations is angrily denying reports that two Sudanese diplomats have been implicated in a planned series of terrorist attacks in New York. Eight men were arrested yesterday and accused of plotting to blow up two tunnels, United Nations headquarters, and a federal building that houses the FBI. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
In a federal complaint filed yesterday, authorities said one of the men arrested had boasted of having connections at the UN who would help him get a car bomb onto the UN grounds. Yesterday, ABC's Nightline said two diplomats from the Sudanese mission had been implicated in the alleged plot. The report said the men were to have provided diplomatic license plates to the vehicle. The State Department today said it had no information that Sudan was behind a specific attack, but a spokesman said officials were unhappy with what he said was a pattern of support for international terrorism by Sudan. Sudan's UN ambassador, Ahmed Suleiman, said the accusations were part of a smear campaign by the Egyptian government, and he said none of his staff had been questioned by police in connection with the alleged plot. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
The FBI says that forensics experts have established a link between mail bombings in New Haven and San Francisco this week and similar attacks dating back to 1978. Yesterday's attack severely wounded a computer scientist at Yale. Earlier this week, a mail bomb wounded a geneticist at the University of California. The FBI says that all the bombings have targeted people in academia, airlines, and high technology industries. One person has been killed and 21 wounded by the attacks over a period of about 15 years. Today, President Clinton named former Washington State Secretary of Health Christine Gebbie as the nation's new federal AIDS coordinator. NPR's Chitra Raghavan has more.
After months of searching for an AIDS czar, President Clinton today named Christine Gebbie to the post in a brief ceremony on the South Lawn. In introducing the former nurse and career public health official, the president said he's confident Gebbie will ensure that the nation no longer ignores the epidemic that has killed so many Americans. And he described why the country needs an AIDS czar.
This position has never existed before, but circumstances now require us to look for unprecedented remedies to an unprecedented problem. Today, as we toil against one of the most dreaded and mysterious diseases humanity has ever known, we must redouble our government's efforts to promote research, funding, and treatment for AIDS.
Ms. Gebbie is expected to coordinate all of the nation's AIDS efforts and formulate AIDS policy. This is Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up a fraction to close at 3,491. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. President Clinton said today that he thinks the deficit reduction package will be strengthened when it goes to a House-Senate conference committee. The measure squeaked through the Senate earlier this morning after Vice President Al Gore stepped in to break a 49-49 vote tie. The House-passed version of the measure contains a broad-based energy tax, while the Senate version replaced that with a gasoline tax. Hundreds of right-wing extremists in Johannesburg stormed the building where top black and white officials are negotiating an end to apartheid. As Anthony Goldman of the BBC reports, the right wing has become increasingly isolated by the talks on South Africa's political future.
Perennial clashes over personality and politics have traditionally left white extremist movements in South Africa divided, confused, and lacking in popular support. In a referendum last year, the country's white population overwhelmingly endorsed President de Klerk's policy of negotiating a new non-racial constitution. But much has changed since then. President de Klerk, the African National Congress, and more than 20 other parties have reached agreement on moving towards elections by April next year. There is a consensus amongst these groups that South Africa should remain a unitary state, with a power-sharing arrangement at the centre and a degree of regional autonomy. The Afrikaner National Front believes that this would lead to a communist South Africa.
The BBC's Anthony Goldman. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy is planning to visit Iowa, Minnesota, and South Dakota next week to see field damage caused by this week's heavy rains. The rains have flooded many fields, keeping farmers from planting crops such as corn and soybeans. Five Midwestern governors requested Espy to visit so that he can see the problems faced by farmers and then recommend federal disaster relief. The flooding has forced the closure of locks and dams on a 215-mile stretch of the Mississippi River. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. For many years and many novels, John le Carré wrote about intrigue and espionage under the rules of the Cold War. The ongoing hostilities between the Soviet Union and the West was the backdrop for his early novels, including the one that made him famous in 1963, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, as well as some of his later books, Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, and Smiley's People. The world of intelligence is one that le Carré knew well at the time. He spent 5 years in the British Foreign Service, where he was known by his real name, David Cornwell. He had been told by his boss that he needed a pen name when he started to write. His new novel, The Night Manager, takes place during the war in the Persian Gulf. It involves international arms and drug dealing and pits a former military intelligence operative named Jonathan Pine against Richard Onslow Roper, a ruthless British arms merchant. John le Carré told me how the end of the Cold War freed him as a writer to take on other issues.
I was getting tired of it. I mean, I was in a sense born into it. That's to say, as soon as I grew up, I took part in it. And then when I got out of the Cold Warrior business, I started writing about it. And I felt that I had exhausted its permutations, if you will, and I was getting a little tired of my main character, George Smiley, and he was getting tired of me. And I also wanted the Cold War to end purely emotionally and politically. I wanted a new deck of cards, and I wanted the world to get out of this awful confrontational trauma and get on with something more positive, more useful, more creative. I was in step with the process.
Were you, though, afraid that if the Cold War had continued that you would be forced to continue to write about it?
No, I think I'd have turned away from it altogether. I mean, I had kind of three shots at leaving it. I thought that in my novel, my autobiographical novel, A Perfect Spy, I'd really finished that stuff. Then with The Russia House, there was a kind of impatience in it which said, when are we going to recognize that the Cold War is over? When will we stop this idiotic arms confrontation when the knight is dying inside his armor? And in The Secret Pilgrim, I really made Smiley get up and say, goodbye, I'm never coming back, I've done it, I've done my best, I lived the passion of my time, bye-bye. And then I would have had to go somewhere else. I would have found some other flashpoint. Let me just put in here, though, please, that although we talk of me very sweetly as a Cold War writer, actually, this is now, this present one, The Night Manager, is my fifth novel, which has absolutely nothing to do with the Cold War.
It's funny how that lingers, isn't it? How that that description of you hangs on.
Yeah, well, it's flattering in a way. And I don't know, to paraphrase Andy Warhol, you can only be famous for one thing.
Well, your new book does involve arms dealing and narcotic trafficking. You've described these as the excesses of capitalism.
That's right.
Explain what you mean.
I mean that During the 80s, when we were very greedy and when we had materialism and affluence instead of morality, if you will, it was still possible to justify the amount we paid ourselves and the amount we ate and the amount we wasted in the context of the economic war with communism. Now that war is over, and the excuse, the justification for self-indulgence, if you will, blind self-indulgence, limitless expansion, that excuse has been removed. And we have to address the consequences of capitalism. And so that's what I'm trying to do in this case. I think that my main character is a creature of excess who seems to have inherited his decadence. and a person of absolutely no personal morality. And he's taking and taking and taking and wrecking the world in the process and people.
One of your characters says, arms are a drug.
Yes, I believe that. He goes on to say, don't believe any of this nonsense you hear about willing seller, willing buyer. It's just another industry. Good heavens, you can go back to your wives and children in the evening and you're just like other people. I have spent quite some time now with, particularly with the illegals, the arms dealers who don't officially work to any government pattern. And I've spent a fair amount of time with others who make arms. I think that it is about male macho. It is that feeling that you have entered some other new state of power and almost something supernatural about people who play. The feeling that some people get from playing with guns. I think it's a great problem, loving guns. It's a great problem when you address the hideous situation that we have now worldwide with all the detritus of the Cold War lying around, huge, great stockpiles of arms just waiting to be used again. It's a great problem that, as we see it from outside, the United States is so tolerant of arms control or no control at home that it really has no credibility as a world policeman in this field.
How close to arms dealers did you get in doing research on this book?
Well, as close as holding hands, except that wasn't why I went. I spent a lot of time with several of them. Some were very amusing and hospitable and very at ease with themselves, like Sam Cummings of InterArms, who gives interviews and is outgoing and is a media man. Two guys you meet in small cafes in Paris back streets and wear Ray-Bans and ask you never to mention their name and all that junk.
Well, I know that you did work in the spy business. Of course, I would assume that would have helped you figure out how to find some of these people.
Well, I don't think that the spy business was very streetwise. I learned an awful lot more about how to get around when I was researching novels than I ever did as a spook.
The other part of this novel deals with narcotics trafficking, and I wonder if there isn't a similar and also different kind of ambivalence about that. One of your characters, and this is actually a Treasury man, says, why are we so squeamish about drugs anyway? Service industry, willing buyer, willing seller, vast profits to the third world. Some of it's going to go to the right places. Must be. We accept tobacco, booze, pollution, pox. Why are we such prudes about drugs? Does he reflect at all any of your thinking?
Well, what I did realize when I got into the drug stuff, I've done it twice. I explored the heroin traffic up in the Shan States in Southeast Asia, north of Burma, when I was writing a book called The Honorable Schoolboy, and then I went back to it for this book, and that was the cocaine scene. The Drug Enforcement Agency tells me that the United States still spends more money on cocaine than it does on food. And the black economy, the scale of it, is absolutely extraordinary. What I discovered was that in third world jargon, cocaine is to some extent the punishment which the gringos deserve. That the coca plant was something that was given to them, as it were, by God. It belonged to their culture for a long time. They chewed the stuff or they did whatever they did with it. And they enjoyed it and they kept it within bounds. And it was we, the White West, if you will, we decadent people, who developed these excessive tastes and put such a premium on the thing and thus altered the economy of Central American and South American states to a great extent. So they see themselves as having a kind of moral position in purveying it, many of them. That's the self-justification. It's much more complicated from their point of view than it is from ours.
You don't think they pay a price? They don't think they pay a price?
Well, they have a bit of an internal drug problem, but I don't think it's anything like on the scale of our own. The drug cartels in Medellin and Cali and so on, they run the thing as a kind of manufacture and export business. And all right, they do a little cocaine or they do this and that, but. It is not an indigenous problem in the way that we have it in certain cities here and in certain cities all over Europe.
Let me get you to read a section from your new novel, The Night Manager, and this is really a description of Jonathan Price.
Jonathan Pine.
Excuse me, Jonathan Pine.
Here he is. He was a compact man, but tentative, with a smile of apologetic self-protection. Even his Englishness was a well-kept secret. He was nimble and in his prime of life. If you were a sailor, you might have spotted him for another, recognized the deliberate economy of his movements, the caged placing of the feet, one hand always for the boat. He had trim, curled hair and a pugilist's thick brow. The pallor of his eyes caught you by surprise. You expected more challenge from him, heavier shadows. And this mildness of manner within a fighter's frame gave him a troubling intensity. You would never, during your stay in the hotel, confuse him with anybody else, not with Herr Stripley, the creamy-haired front-of-house manager, not with one of Herr Meister's superior young Germans who strode through the place like gods on their way to stardom somewhere else. As a hotelier, Jonathan was complete. You did not wonder who his parents were, or whether he listened to music, or kept a wife and children, or a dog. His gaze, as he watched the door, was steady as a marksman's. He wore a carnation. At night, he always did.
That's John le Carré reading from The Night Manager, his new novel. Do you fashion your characters on people that you've known? Is that something even that you consciously do?
Yeah, people I know, people I look at. I think when novel starts forming in your head, and the characters particularly start standing out and wanting to be described and counted and formed, I find myself greatly stimulated by any casual thing I see in the street or round a dinner table or the odd word that I hear, and I keep battered notebooks and rush off to the men's room and scribble down my stuff. And then I get all these little bits and notions, and he would make this gesture, he would have that kind of voice, this cadence, this accent, these mannerisms, and then I start putting them together. But what really makes them sit up and work, of course, is the moment where you can breathe something of your own nature into them, so that one is really playing, as I like to say, with the possibilities of one's own character.
Jonathan Pine has a kind of a smile that he uses as a mask, it seems to me, and there were a number of references through the novel to a particular kind of smile that he had. Were you paying close attention to that at all?
Yes, I see manners, very good manners, as something like a refuge from engagement, a form of self-protection. And among the Brits, that curious choreography we have in society, manners can be a form of arrogance. So I'm very interested in a man like Jonathan Pine, who has military experience, who's been a secret soldier, has fought in Ireland and that stuff, and gets himself into all the gear of being super smart, you know, the linoleum suit, the dinner jacket, all the junk, and does his hair nicely and puts a buttonhole in his pocket. And somewhere inside Jonathan is a very violent man, so that the tension of seeing him behave with such beautiful manners and such pretty turns of phrase, the tension inside the reader is stretched by the disproportion between the way he behaves and the way he is inside.
Do you see your protagonists as unlikely?
Yes, I see, in a sense, most stories as unlikely. But, you know, readers and viewers at the cinema or at the television, they want to be able to suspend their faculty of judgment in favor of joining the party, joining the story, entering it. I don't want to be authentic. People very sweetly have assumed at one time or another that I was the head of the British Secret Service or whatever. That's a kind of sweet compliment. I want to be credible and persuasive, plausible. I want to enchant. I want to take my reader with me. I don't want to show him. I don't want to show him how the armchair is assembled. I want him to sit in it and take off.
You worked for the British Secret Service. Did that help you as a writer? And you were just mentioning how.
Oh yes.
Yeah. I mean, the ability, I guess, to I don't know how much cloak and dagger stuff you did, but the ability to impersonate or to become another person.
Well, I was never as clandestine or as dramatically engaged as that. I think that I was always a writer who became a spook for a while, rather than a spook who became a writer. I once, Graham Greene was also in the Secret Service. There's a kind of tradition about it in Britain. I don't know why. But I asked Graham whether he'd enjoyed it, and he said he had a very slight, rough, sort of royal R. And he said, no, anyway, I was frightful at it. Were you? And I said, yes, I think I really was. And he said every time he sat down to write a report, he really wanted to write what it might have been like. He wanted to juice it up because all the boring banalities, the information that he'd gathered, were quite insufficient to his writing nature.
So you found it boring as well? Is that why you weren't good at it?
No, I think it's why I wrote. I found it insufficient, but I think that, you know, I went through a lot of institutional lives. I was a schoolmaster. I taught at Eton for a while. I've done other kinds of government work that weren't spookery. And none of it was satisfying to me. And no uncreative life would ever have satisfied me.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And my guest today is John le Carré, and he's written a new novel called The Night Manager. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with novelist John le Carré, and his new book is called The Night Manager. I'd like to talk a little bit about your father.
Uh-huh.
And he was a con man.
Mm-hmm.
Your novel of Perfect Spy was based on your father.
Yes.
Have you come to see him, or did you see him even as a young man or a child as a kind of double agent because of the fact that he was a con man?
Well, being a child, I was much more self-centered, so I saw myself as a double agent because he was a con man. He was a sort of multiple agent. You never knew where he was going to pop up next. I mean, when you wanted him to zig, he zagged. And those guys, they're like actors who write their own lines and parts. I mean, he would see a scam and he would dress for it and make his pitch and secure his collaborators, investors, victims. And he would live a whole existence until the deal fell apart or he made rather grubby money. The effect of this life upon ourselves as children, I think, was that we had to compose characters that were resilient enough to the vicissitudes of that life. And we also had, as creatures of his ambition, he was enormously ambitious and enormously loving towards his children in his own way, we had to pretend that we were the children of the man he was pretending to be. So he was saying, I'm this rich tycoon, I'm this generous man, I support charities, I do this and that. And we would echo all this stuff and look like dear, sweet, well-educated, well-parented, middle-class kids going off to school in press grey suits and going through the private education stuff when he could afford to pay the fees, or somebody else could. And meanwhile, we knew we had undefended backs. We knew that where we came from was chaos. And so conformity, integration with society, became almost a visceral need. It's something that sprang from a childhood appetite to find recognition in the collective because there was no recognition back at home. I mean, no recognizable form for one's life back at home.
What was your father's charm? Because it seemed that he, even to the very end, was able to get away with all sorts of scams, and it must have been something that he exuded to be able to do that.
Yeah, he was terribly good. He was a great student of human weakness, having most of the weaknesses himself, and being instinctively a communicator and a joiner and a palsy kind of man. He was very quick to detect people's appetites and weaknesses and things. And if he had a sense of their sexuality, he would try to supply that in some way through introductions, bring on the dancing girls and whatnot. If he felt that what they really needed was here, you know, with their wives, a little holiday somewhere, he would arrange it. He was marvelous at the gifting side of it all, at the obtaining of people, at putting stuff into the favors bank and calling on those favors at crucial moments. And he could also bully.
And yet you said you felt he loved you mm-hmm. in his own way. Could you trust that kind of love from that kind of father?
No, absolutely not. And nor could you reciprocate it.
So that was, I guess, an ongoing issue?
Yes, until I wrote the book about it. But I don't think, I mean, you have in the States, you have some very good books on the subject. There's The Duke of Deception by Wolfe. That's right, Geoffrey Wolfe.
Right.
Which very much records my own experience. And indeed, when my elder brother read that book, he said, I'm not going to bother to write about father. This guy's done it wonderfully. You don't forgive. You don't forget. And you find it terribly hard to produce the love you feel you ought to feel for that parent. That was a real obstruction when I was writing A Perfect Spy. And it wasn't until I was able to make the son even more awful than the father that I got away from the whinging tone and the self-pitying and got it straight. But as to love, it doesn't... I don't think time makes it any easier. I'm afraid the older I get, the more fascinated I become by my childhood, which I think actually is common to many people.
Well, I don't want to get too Freudian here with you, but do you think a lot of your books have really been in some way about your father, or about the duplicitousness of him?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And I often think that my relationship with Smiley is a relationship with an idealized father figure. Hmm. You know, Smiley was always much older than I am. He had a lot of social clumsiness, which I feel I have, and yet at the same time saw a lot, functioned well, got by. And yeah, and then the obsession with untruth, with duplicity, with fork-tongued behavior, that flowed naturally through my experience of my father and then into the secret world.
My guest today is John Le Carré, and we're talking about a book he's just written, his latest novel called The Night Manager. Your new novel is about arms dealing and narcotic trafficking. Do you see these as equally or even more destabilizing than the Cold War?
Yes, I do. I mean, for as long as drugs in different forms generate this huge black economy and produce private armies around the place, for as long as we have no real effective embargo system on supplying the craziest people with weaponry, for as long as we allow all the old weaponry from the Cold War to slosh around the world for adventurers to pick up, buy, trade in, steal, we shall run great risks. So I think that if one were looking for the common targets of intelligence operations, one would be going for drugs, for arms, for terrorism, which is very often associated with both, and then into the totally unglamorous but crucial things like the raid upon the ecology, famine, the things that actually make the world so sad. The Cold War gave us an excuse for not bothering with those things, mm-hmm. but now we don't have it.
Jean Le Carré's new novel is called The Night Manager. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moskowain with Fresh Air. Coming up, the trials and tribulations of a Little League coach. For 9 years, CBS correspondent Bill Geis coached his son's, then his daughter's team, and says he dealt with everything from bathroom breaks to angry parents. His book is Little League Confidential. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new solo album by Donald Fagen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton kept a low profile today after praising Senate approval of his economic plan and naming an aid czar. Mr. Clinton has spent the last few weeks lobbying for his package of spending cuts and tax increases that now have to be worked out in House-Senate conference negotiations. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Clinton stayed awake for the 3 a.m. vote, and although Vice President Al Gore had to break the tie, he praised the Senate for showing a remarkable degree of courage. Six Democrats joined Senate Republicans and opposed the economic plan. Still, the president predicts with a little prodding from the White House, the package that will emerge from the conference committee will draw additional votes.
This administration was not nearly as involved in the details of what came out of the Senate as was the case in the House. I am confident that the conferees will get together and will produce a bill that in some ways is superior to both bills and will have a broader support.
Conferees will be named Monday but won't begin work until after the 4th of July recess. Meanwhile, the new president will be tested on another front at the upcoming economic summit in Tokyo. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Also in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has made it much more difficult for employees to win job discrimination lawsuits. By a 5-4 vote, the High Court said that when an employer's stated reason for firing or demoting an employee turns out to be false, the employee may still not win his or her case. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The case before the court involved the demotion and firing of Melvin Hicks, a correctional officer at the St. Mary's Halfway House in Missouri. Hicks, who is black, showed at trial that he was qualified for the position he held, had for many years gotten good evaluations, and that he was fired and replaced by a white man. St. Mary's explained the firing as the result of disciplinary problems with Hicks, but the trial judge found that this explanation did not hold water, since no other employee had been fired for similar disciplinary problems. Still, the judge ruled against Hicks because he said the firing might have been based on personal animosity rather than racial animosity. An appeals court reversed the ruling, declaring that once an employer's explanation for a firing has been shown to be false, the employee wins automatically. Today, the Supreme Court disagreed and, in so doing, repudiated the way most courts have handled employment discrimination cases for the last 20 years. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Flooding has closed two sets of locks in the Mississippi River, thus bringing traffic to a halt for more than 200 miles. Heavy rain has fallen this week in parts of Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, and one official predicts that through traffic in the river will be stopped for 2 weeks. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than 1 point to close at 3,490.89 on volume of more than 206 million shares. This is NPR News. In New York City, the U.N. Security Council has postponed a scheduled vote on a plan to lift an arms embargo against the Muslim-led government of Bosnia. A call for postponement was made after it appeared the measure would fail. Two of the five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council reportedly indicated that they would veto the plan. While the Clinton administration has supported lifting a weapons embargo against the Bosnian government, it has not pushed the idea in face of Allied opposition. Astronauts on the Space Shuttle Endeavour have completed their spacewalk, and officials at NASA say it's been a very productive day for the crew. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE has more on the story.
Astronauts David Lowe and Jeff Weisshoff spent about 5.5 hours floating inside Endeavour's payload bay. The first task was to lock down the two antennas on the Eureka Science satellite, now tucked inside the shuttle. Once that was completed, Lowe and Weisshoff began testing techniques that will be used to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. Lowe guided Weisshoff through the payload bay to simulate what it would be like to move objects of large mass in microgravity. That will play an important role when astronauts begin working with replacement parts for the Hubble telescope in December. Some of the test activities were cut short, though, as the time scheduled for the spacewalk ran out. The rest of the mission will take place with work inside the SpaceHab module. Landing is set for Tuesday at the Kennedy Space Center. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
In France, a fire has destroyed a private clinic, killing at least 18 people and injuring 35 others. One official said that arson has not been ruled out in the case. The three-story stone building, built more than 100 years ago, did not have fire alarms or other safety systems. 17 patients in the clinic and one nurse died in the blaze, the worst in the country in 2 years. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. You may think that Major League Baseball is tough, but it's child's play compared to the intensity found on Little League ball fields. The kids aren't the problem. It's the high-strung, obnoxious parents who threaten coaches and publicly humiliate their own children. Bill Geis currently works as a features correspondent for CBS News. His book, Little League Confidential, is a funny behind-the-scenes exposé of the game. He coached Little League in Ridgewood, New Jersey for 9 years when his son and daughter were young. It took him a while to finally figure out the personality transformation that these parents undergo. He calls it Little League Syndrome.
Well, I hadn't really identified it. I thought maybe it was just peculiar to me, but I think it came when I saw my son go up to bat for the first time in Little League when he was about 7 or 8 years old, and I turned into something of a monster. I started yelling at the umpire, wanting to do in the other kids on the other team who all wanted to get my little boy out for some reason. He had all these 9 people facing him, wanting to do him ill, wishing him ill. So I think that's when it first came to me.
Well, there is, of course, the things that you say out loud at a Little League game, and then there's the internal monologue, the things that you say to yourself.
Right, and some people say them all out loud. And those are some of the people that I write about in the book. Or you find that's part of Little League syndrome, is some of those things that you maybe think normally about other drivers, other people all the time, that starts coming out. You find yourself saying these things, screaming them, or you're sitting next to someone who's saying, "Strike the bum out." And he's talking about your 7-year-old son. And so that's when it gets a little testy in the stand.
Well, you know, baseball is really a very cruel game. And I often wonder, how do you explain to a 7-year-old that even the best players playing on the best major league teams are only going to get to base with a hit about a third of the time? And that's a very cruel lesson about baseball, of course, also about life.
It is. It's one of the reasons. Kids, for some reason, to me, I think they're less and less able to accept that. They want to succeed every time, or their parents want them to succeed every time. And it's kind of a serious point. I used to have a talk with people. I'm talking about my players as people. They're not real people. No, they're little people. And I'd tell them that very thing. I mean, that Don Mattingly was earning $5 million a year, and he was getting one hit. He's getting 3 hits out of every 10 at bats, and that they shouldn't expect to do much better. But for some reason, either the kids or the parents, or I don't know where they get it, they're not really satisfied with that explanation. I mean, they want 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10.
Well, again, I don't think a 7-year-old could really comprehend that.
No, I know. So it's a very difficult thing to try and explain to them. As you say, it is kind of a cruel game, actually, and that comes to you right on the first time your son or daughter gets up to bat and you realize that. I was on the wrestling team for a while in high school, and very poor, I must say, as a wrestler. And it's sort of like that. I mean, you're kind of one-on-one. You're up to bat. If you strike out, that's your fault. I mean, you did that. It's not like soccer or football or lacrosse or something like that, where you kind of blend into the action, and what you do is kind of dependent on what the other players are doing. Perhaps you can blame a horrendous mistake on somebody else, or maybe no one's watching you, but there you are when you're up to bat for all the world to see, and when you strike out, it's a terrible moment.
Now, I assume when you played Little League, there were no girls that were playing on the teams that you were involved in, but certainly girls do play with boys on Little League teams. They tend to be in the minority, but you
Definitely.
Do see them.
Yeah.
How much do you think the game is still about fathers and sons, and what did you do with the girls on your team?
Well, that's always an interesting thing. Well, I like to think that I treated the girls pretty much the same way that I treated the boys. I mean, we in the book, we have an episode where we treat one of the girls rather poorly, trying to convince her in a critical situation to go two blocks away to go to the little girl's room when it's her turn at bat because she wasn't very good. On the other hand, I was criticized by a reader for saying that, but the fact is my leadoff hitter was a tiny little girl named Emily who she'd come up to bat and all the boys would be whispering out in the field, "Move up, it's a girl," and all that. And we placed her first in the batting order to demoralize the other team because she would always hit a double or something to start the game and make them feel badly. And, of course, there's also something in the book about a girl who hit a home run wearing a tutu. She came from ballet class and put her shorts on over a tutu. It was kind of sticking out the top of her shorts. She hit a home run, and I'm assuming the boy who threw that home run pitch is in therapy somewhere today.
But did your team members accept these girls after the home runs and tutus?
Yes, I think so. I think the boys did. There's a difficult thing sometimes with girls. They have trouble at the early ages in, you know, competing with the boys in some of the athletic endeavors, and some of them are kind of forced on the teams by fathers who say, you know, my daughter's as good as any boy, and sometimes there's a social aspect to it as well. My daughter's a pretty good athlete, and she has a good friend whose father is constantly forcing her to play on boys' teams so that she will improve and one day be much better than all the girls because she's played at a more competitive level. But she hates it. She cries and all this kind of thing. So, I mean, there are problems that way, too. There are social aspects to it that have to be addressed. But in the early ages, I think 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, there are always girls now in our little league in the town that I live in. And, I mean, if they could compete and play, I mean, it was they treated pretty much like everybody else. I mean, the boys who don't do well on the teams are not having that much fun either. I mean, it's kind of just a skill thing, really.
Well, you also describe the kind of natural enmity between coaches. And having sat through many Little League games on the sidelines or being a team mother, it is an amazing thing to watch the level of competition between coaches. I don't know whether it's testosterone. I don't know whether it's upbringing or exactly what it is. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I think it's just kind of a naturally competitive. With me, the things that I admit to in the book, my worst moments as a coach always came about against these other coaches who had kind of, I thought they'd kind of cheated at the draft, or I knew it meant so much to them to beat me that I would start competing with the other coach. And that's where Little League gets all completely out of whack. It's where two coaches are kind of playing a chess game, and the kids are pawns, and the coaches really don't care whether the kids are having fun or not. They're out there to win, and there we have coaches like that. I always want to say there's a coach in our town, and I always want to, you know, ask him how the season's going, and just to say to him, well, as long as your team's in first place, I guess we're having a good, you know, a good year and with Little League.
Well, I want to talk some more, but we have to take a very short break, and my guest today is Bill Geist, and we're talking about Little League. It's a sport that he has coached for a number of years now. His book about his experiences is out in paperback, and it's called Little League Confidential. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Geist, and we're talking about Little League. Well, we must spend, I think, some more time talking about parents. And as a coach, I assume you really do have to deal with these parents in a very, intimate kind of a way. Again, what was the hardest thing about being a coach in dealing with parents?
Well, you kind of have to take it case by case, but I mean, there were always parents calling. I remember one episode when there was a boy on our team who struck out and he was beating his bat into the ground and crying and all this. And I went over and put my arm around him and was comforting him. And when the game was over, the boy's mother, I thought, was coming over to thank me for being so kind to him and all this and helping him through this. And she told me that I was to keep my hands off of her son and that he had to work through his own problems. And so, I mean, you just never know where it's coming from next. I mean, obviously you get calls all the time about my son, my daughter should be playing more in the infield. And sometimes you put kids in the outfield for self-protection. Some of the kids don't want to be there. Some kids recognize that they're not good enough, perhaps, to play first base and have balls thrown very rapidly at them all the time. They don't want to be there. They might plead. They're kids who don't want to be there at all. I mean, they'll sit in the dugout and plead not to be put in the game. And you have to explain to them there are rules of fairness that they have to play so many innings and so on. But with the parents, and they really are the only real problem, I think, with Little League. I mean, you just never know where it's coming from with them.
Well, now your son played on your team, and I assume that all the parents of the other kids on your team assume that you were going to give him preferential treatment.
Well, I have a two-part answer for that. One is that, yes, you do give your own child preferential treatment, and I think at some level you figure all this time that you're putting in, the unpaid hours and hours that you put in and talking to parents on the phone and rushing home from work to be there on time and, you know, driving on the shoulder of the highway so that you can get to the games on time and being arrested for speeding and all this kind of stuff, that, yes, you deserve to give your kid a little bit of preferential treatment. It does turn out normally that the kids of coaches are often a little bit better than the other kids simply because their parents put so much stock in how good their kids play.
You've really described a lot of the sort of downsides of
yeah.
Little League, but certainly, again, from my experience, as much as there are those long and horrible moments, that there are those times when, you know, when the klutziest kid on the team finally gets a hit. And I'm not sure there's words to describe the feeling of watching that. I can only imagine how the child feels, but as an interested parent on the sideline, to see a kid actually catch a ball for the first time, it's really wonderful.
Yeah, I think that's the real satisfaction in coaching. And these always sound like the endings to Hollywood productions,
yeah.
But they happen all the time. That's the real satisfaction, I think, are the kids that don't play very well, that you're actually able to teach them something and that they enjoy the game more, which I think is what it was supposed to be all about to begin with.
Well, is that why you coach, for those small moments?
No, it's for the grotesquely preferential treatment for your son and daughter.
I like your honesty.
Okay. But I'm still kind of hanging around coaching my daughter a little bit in softball. We're the Tarvin Fighting Realtors this year, and we had baby blue caps, and which is not a good color to have, by the way. You like to get the red or dark blue color, and you always pray too. We have a team in town that's sponsored by the Ridgewood Corset Shop, and the boys in particular can't stand to be on that team and have that emblazoned across their backs the whole season. So, light blue caps and Ridgewood Corset Shop, you don't stand much of a chance.
Well, you know what I've enjoyed, again, watching from the sidelines, is seeing grown-up men talking to little kids about baseball and about being with them through their disappointments, being with them through their moments of triumph.
Mm-hmm. I think about that, too. I see these kids, some of my daughter's friends that you know, she played on teams with, and I mean, I can remember, you know, when I think there is, you do, there's kind of a special bond. It is, after all, you know, for whatever. Maybe we need the organization to make us spend time with kids that we would not normally have done. I mean, I probably would not have been, you know, driving home at 90 miles an hour, sitting on the bus cursing in traffic, leaving the office. It was the only thing, you know, in our driven with our careers and so on. It was the only thing that would get me home early on time. It was the only possible thing in the world that could have gotten me home at 6 o'clock or 5:30 or whatever when the game starts. So perhaps we need these organized activities to make us do such things.
Well, thank you very much, Bill Geis, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bill Geis' book is called Little League Confidential. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Robert, what stories will you be covering for us?
Well, Marty, we'll be hearing more about the plot announced by the FBI and the New York police yesterday, the plot to plant bombs in the commuter tunnels into Manhattan and the United Nations building. We'll hear what's said today by, among others, Sudan's ambassador to the United Nations, who denies any connection to this plot. Also today, we'll be hearing what's next for President Clinton's budget plan. We'll be hearing about a Senate subcommittee's report on the biggest nonprofit health insurer in the country and its mismanagement. And we'll also be talking with Christopher Hogwood about conducting Mozart.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Donald Fagen is best known as one half of the old rock band Steely Dan. The other half was guitarist and producer Walter Becker. Steely Dan dissolved in 1980, and 2 years later, Fagen released a highly praised solo album, Nightfly. There's been no new work from Fagen until now, with the release of Comma Kyriad, which also reunites him with Becker. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. The first song in the album is this one, Trans Island Skyway.
I was born yesterday when they brought my Comma Kyriad, when they handed me the keys. It's a steam power 10, the frame is out of Glasgow, the tech is Balinese. It's not a freeway bullet or a bug with monster wheels, it's a total bias fit. Well, the farm in the back,
in 70s rock music, irony abounded. Think of Randy Newman's sarcastic variations on singer-songwriter conventions, or of David Bowie's constant shape-shifting. But it was Steely Dan that made irony catchy, and although Comma Kyriad is labeled a Donald Fagen album, it's really the best Steely Dan record since Katie lied in 1975. Set in the future, this is a suite of road songs about a guy who's zipping across cyberspace in a futuristic car called a Comma Kyriad. In the 11 years since his last record, Fagen seems to have read a lot of William Gibson and James Ellroy, and to have fully anticipated Wild Palms in the matter of sun-drenched dread. Comma Kyriad is a glide across an America where the sandy dunes of a Los Angeles beach are, he says, a joyless place where this loneliness began. It's where carnivals offer holographic rides in which you relive all your bad love affairs. Still, Fagen hasn't forgotten how to make despair sound awfully alluring.
Drive along the sea far from the city's twitch and smoke to a misty beach. It's where my life became a joke on the dunes.
and seabirds cry on the dune.
With Walter Becker on board as producer and guitarist, this album plays Steely Dan's standard trick. Slick, pretty music decorating harrowing, downbeat lyrics. You hear the trick done well on that song, On the Dunes, in which the narrator asserts that his life is little more than a joke. Kamakiriad is a beautiful but deeply pessimistic, even rather nasty album. At one point in this vision of the future, Fagan refers to women as a virus wearing pumps and pearls. Listening to it, you realize how music has changed in the decades since Steely Dan prevailed. The compositions on Kamakiriad have a languor and discursiveness that's just utterly unlike today's pumped-up pop.
On a night like this, you look up at your lover. It's like you're in some old cartoon. Then you detect the scent of faded roses up in the sky. It's that cruel kind of moon. Could that be murder? You see.
Fagan and Becker are, by the way, mounting a Steely Dan reunion tour this summer. I would warn them off this project with a personal anecdote. When Rolling Stone was updating its illustrated history of rock and roll last year, I got a call from an editor who said they'd be cutting the chapter I had written on Steely Dan from the new edition. Why? Because, the editor told me, they're over. They're pretty much irrelevant now. On a song here called Snowbound, Fagan sings, "Wake me up when the wolves come out to play." To which I can only say, wake up, Don, they're here.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Donald Fagan's new album is Kamakiriad. Interviews and reviews on Fresh Air are produced by Joan Tuohy, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, and edited by Sue Weinstein and Bill Duhart. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Ed Harris on the joys and dangers of acting. He almost died while shooting underwater scenes for the film The Abyss. Harris also starred in The Right Stuff and Glengarry Glen Ross. His newest film is The Firm. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.